by 12 o'clock, we were then in a position to go to a question time briefing with the Attorney General. So Lionel Bowen and Michael Tait and the advisors used to sit down from about 12:30 until 1 or a little bit after, going through the question time briefs and making sure that the ministers were ready for what questions they may get, but also, of course, preparing the Dorothy Dixes for both ministers. So that was a very important part of my role every day, was to make when Parliament was sitting.
So that reminds me of another thing. Could you describe, if such a thing really existed, a typical day in doing your job?
In the office by 7:30, 7:45. Generally beating the minister, but not every day. The press secretary used to be with me because he actually lived at my house when we were in Parliament House, for a long time, in Michael's office. And so the first thing we would get from the department was usually at about 8 o'clock, we got a press clip. So, you know, it was about that thick. It was the Attorney General's press clip, but of course it came to us as well. And the minister had one and I had one, and I went through it with the press secretary, and we, you know, made sure that there weren't any issues that we didn't know about. And so my focus then for the first hour was on getting ready for getting everything in place for possible parliamentary questions. So we would do all of that, and I made a phone call to the department then by 9 o'clock to give them time to prepare the what we used to call the PPQs, possible parliamentary questions. Once that was out of the way, then from 9 o'clock on, generally I would get a delivery from the department of folders. And they'd be in those colours I mentioned, red and green and blue and brown and black and yellow and all of those sort of things. And I would go through most of them personally. A couple of the things that related to, I suppose, legislation questions. John Rao was the lawyer in the office who and had a legislative background, and as I mentioned, he became a Member of Parliament in South Australia as the Attorney General. So if there were legislative things, generally I gave them to John to look at. And so probably by 10:30, I'd have been through all of the things that day that were delivered that morning and made notes, and they'd go into the minister's office, and they were in various piles, so the minister knew which ones were important first and so on. And occasionally I'd hear, "Darryl!" he didn't have to yell very loudly, I can tell you, from, you know, the size of the office. But, you know, we'd then talk about issue. I might have made a notation that he wanted to discuss or that sort of thing. And so I'd sit down and go through some of those things with him. Generally, there wasn't a lot of that in the early days. It was, we were all feeling our way in some respects. That first, 8 months, September 87 till May 88, in Old Parliament House, there were some interesting events that occurred that affected my minister. One of the things that my minister did have ongoing responsibility for was the Australasian Police Ministers Council. So I'd gone from being the secretary now to advising the minister. And in, I think it was early November, I don't know the precise date, but there were two firearms incidents, the Hoddle and Queen Street massacres. And the issue of firearms control had been something that was on the agenda of the Police Minister's Council back into the Fraser years, and I can't remember the precise time, but Malcolm Fraser certainly moved during the course of his Prime Ministership to see whether the Commonwealth could move firearms controls issues along. The constitutional issue is that firearms control is a state responsibility other than at the barrier. In other words, customs imports to Australia were the responsibility of the Commonwealth. Licensing and possession and all of those things, the responsibility of the states. When Hoddle and Queen Street occurred, Bob Hawke decided to call a special premier's conference to discuss guns. And again, I can't remember the precise date, but I think it was early December of that 1987. There was a Premier's Conference held in the old Cabinet Room here in Old Parliament House. I think all Premiers attended with the exception of Tasmania. Tasmania was represented by the Deputy Premier John Bennett. But Barry Unsworth was the Premier in New South Wales. And I must say I can't remember who the other Premiers were. But my minister attended, of course, as the minister with direct responsibility for firearms, and I sat with him in the Cabinet Room and we debated the issue for a number of hours, and there was no agreement, chiefly because Queensland and Tasmania resisted any change. They didn't believe that their firearms laws were so bad as to require any change, and in any event, it's nothing to do with you sort of thing. You know, this is our responsibility. I think that there wasn't a great sort of reaction to it. I think Mr. Hawke was probably a little bit disappointed. My minister thought, well, you know, that's what happens at these things. But I've heard subsequently an apocryphal story that has been relayed to me by two or three people, was that walking out of the Cabinet Room, Barry Unsworth put his arm around John Bennett's shoulder, John Bennett being the Deputy Premier of Tasmania, and saying, "John, I suppose it'll take a massacre in Tassie to change your mind." Now, I don't know, I didn't hear it myself, it's others have said that to me, but contemporaneously, not after many years, during the early 88 and that sort of thing, when we were going through that sort of thing. So that was obviously a pretty important event when you think of future things that I've been involved in. There were a couple of other incidents that I thought about. One was related to a Freedom of Information request that was made to the Australian Federal Police in relation to an Asian man named Dr. Stanley Ho, who was involved with casinos, and there was some suggestion that he might have had organised crime connections, etc. And I'm just trying to think, the member for Dawson, I can't think of his name. He was a National Party member for Dawson at that time, but he made a request, a Freedom of Information request, seeking what the AFP had advised the minister in terms of Dr. Stanley Ho. And we received a brief from the AFP, and as was often, you got an FOI thing that had black marks on the pages. And my minister clearly then got a question in the parliament from a colleague of the member for Dawson. Can the minister advise, you know, what the AFP have told you about Dr. Stanley Ho? And so my minister read all of the bits except the black bits, but then he said at the end, and that was the full extent of the briefing I received from the Australian Federal Police. Well, of course, in reality, those blacked out parts we actually did see. So there was a motion of no confidence moved against the minister, and you know, so we had a debate in Michael's first 3 months of being a minister of a motion of no confidence. It was actually won because the West Australian Greens held the balance of power, I think, Christabel Chamaret and Dee Margetts. So they voted in the motion of no confidence, so it was. But of course, I remember Senator Peter Walsh saying to Michael, you don't worry about these motions of no confidence. It's like being slapped over the wrist with a wet bus ticket. Because the government, of course, didn't have the numbers in the Senate. It had to rely on Brian Harradine and the two West Australian Greens. There was another interesting evening occurrence. It was the time of Senate estimates. And when the particular committee that didn't include us was not on, often my colleague Adrian Wilde and I went and had dinner. And this was in the days before mobile phones. So unbeknown to us, the Treasury was in front of the Senate Estimates Committee. And somebody asked a question about Paul Keating's travel allowance. And the Treasury people said that they had, it wasn't Treasury, it was Admin Services, because they provided services to ministers. And they responded that the matter had been referred to the Australian Federal Police. So my minister was in his office, and he tells the story that the door burst open and in walked Paul Keating. And one might, if you know his history, you would probably believe that it was a fairly interesting conversation. My minister then tried to find me, and he ended up ringing my wife and and all. Anyway, we came back a couple of hours later and he was not in a good mood. But we solved the problem fairly quickly, but it was an interesting experience for the minister to have the treasurer burst into his office.
This was the time when you were still here at Old Parliament.
We're still at Old Parliament House, yes.
So obviously your days were pretty full with activities at all hours. How do you know the working hours that you had?
Senate used to sit into the deep night just about every time they sat. We didn't get up until about 10 o'clock most evenings. So my day started, as I said, at about 7:30. We finished about 10. I got home at about 10:30, and I was back in the office the next morning at 7:30.
How did this impact on your social and family life?
At that stage, we had one child. She would have been in kindergarten, I think, when I joined Michael. She was born in late 83, so yes, she would have been 4 years old. My wife was working full-time, so we just... It became part of the way that we lived. my second child was born while I was working for Michael still, but we were up the hill in 89. We still had an active social life. I mean, you had weekends and that sort of thing. I travelled a lot because almost every time that Michael went back to Hobart, I spent at least a week in Hobart. Because, of course, the work of a minister doesn't stop when Parliament isn't sitting. The process of administering or being a minister, looking after a department, or went on. So, you know, we used to get the air freight down every day with a whole heap of...
So you stayed with him where he...
Not everywhere. Not everywhere. I wouldn't go every time there was a parliamentary break. Oh, sorry, I wouldn't go for the full time. I often went down for 2 or 3 days. Yeah. But he was looked after by Adrian and others in his office down there. But quite often... And, of course, the other part of that is when Parliament isn't sitting, the minister goes other places as well. And most of the time I would accompany him on those trips, myself and the Press Secretary generally.
Yeah.
So giving speeches and all of that sort of thing.
I'll come back to that travel issue a bit later on. Just a question, while we're still at sort of old Parliament House, were parts of this building that you used every day and those ones that you used only occasionally? Or were you sort of all the way in the back of the Senate?
Well, most of the time you're in the office. Would often go and sit in when debates were on, when the minister was leading the legislation on the Attorney General side, or health, or we had Aboriginal affairs and that sort of thing. I mean, I'm pretty sure. I'm not sure. Certainly one of the great debates that I remember him being involved in, and I'm not sure, I think it was up in the new Parliament House, was the ATSIC legislation, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Commission. And I remember that Michael and Fred Cheney spent 18, 20 hours debating that bill between the two of them. But I'm not quite sure where that happened, but I know that was a... I think it was somewhere near the longest time debating a piece of legislation in the history of the Senate up until that time. I think it's been broken since, but I can't remember whether that was here or up on the new Parliament House.
So on a sort of regular basis, do you attend sessions in the chamber, or only when your minister was in?
The only occasions would have been Senate estimates committees were often held in the chamber because it was the biggest room and it was the place where you could get most people in. Question time occasionally, but usually the only other time would be when Michael was doing legislation.
What was your impression of the, you know, the debate, standard of debate and the kind of atmosphere in the chamber when you attended?
Well, of course, it was a much cosier chamber than the current one. I think there were some very great politicians and debaters in those days. I mean, Senator Gareth Evans was, you know, a joy to watch and to listen. On the other side, you had Fred Cheney. Just trying to think of others. There were some very good ones. The President of the Senate was... I can't even remember who the President of the Senate was. It wasn't somebody. But I think... Overall, I think it was a pretty good standard. I believe that period was, however, that early period of the Labor government was the beginning of there being a lot more argy-bargy, vitriol, yelling sort of stuff going on in the Parliament, and I think it's continued to this day. So I think it was the start of that process of change in debate, and I think it's also changed the relationships outside the chamber too, much more so when we moved up the hill, of course.
I was actually coming to that. The transition to the Australian Parliament House happened, in the mid-'88.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk about the move up then? Did the work arrangements and procedures change working there compared to what it had been working here in the old Parliament House? Or were there any other differences that impacted directly on the way you worked?
Internally, not a lot of change other than having so much more room. The move was as smooth as anything there. You know, I mean, the office up on the new Parliament House was ready. Everything was there, phones and computers or whatever we had in those days, I can't remember. But everything was there before we moved up the hill. So basically all that had to move were the papers.
Mm.
And that happened in 2 days. And everything went in its right place. And it was an amazing difference, though, in terms of quality of accommodation and the fact that I had an office that was as big as the minister's office in Old Parliament House. The minister's office was as big as the whole office of himself and the staff. And then we had a kitchen, we had our own photocopier, all of those sorts of things. I mean, even as a minister, we shared facilities in the old Parliament House, mainly because there wasn't enough room to put a photocopier in every office, so there was a room set aside. Mm. But the biggest change that I noticed was that we were no longer surrounded by senators. In the old Parliament House, the ministers were in the Senate, if they were in the Senate, and they had senators who were without portfolio or were members of the opposition spread around, that sort of thing. When we moved up to new Parliament House, you actually had to make a deliberate effort to go and visit, or senators had to walk a long way, or members, to come and see the minister. The ministerial wing made an enormous change to the dynamics, I think, in terms of how the Parliament works vis-a-vis the ministry. A huge change.
But from the sound of it, it would also have impacted directly on maybe how you worked yourself and your relationship with others around in others in the building and others.
Well, I think we certainly had close relationships with the Attorney General's office because that was part of our portfolio. Mm. So, I mean, we worked closely together every day with the Attorney General in terms of. The other office that we worked closely with was, the Attorney General, the original Attorney General we had was Lionel Bowen, who was also Deputy Prime Minister. When he retired, Brian Howe became the Deputy Prime Minister, but he was the Minister for Health. But we represented health on the Senate side. So we had that very close relationship with the Deputy Prime Minister's office and health. And, of course, we had the Attorney General, who was Michael Duffy. So, those sorts of things. And then you got to know the adjacent ministers' offices reasonably well. So across the corridor from us was Robert Ray. And across the other corridor was Nick Balkas. So, we had close relationships with them.
You said you represented the ministers in the Senate, other ministers from the House of Representatives. Did that mean that you actually took on the role of managing that part of it, or did the minister's staff in the House of Representatives provide you with material that you would make sure that the minister representing?
Combination of both. We would attend part of the question time briefing in Lionel's office and then Brian Howe's office. But we didn't attend all of it because we had to go to the Attorney General as well. So we had to do two separate briefings. I should say back here, we represented Aboriginal Affairs and Gerry Hand was the minister. But fortunately, he was only two offices away, so we had, you know, a brief time with him on Aboriginal Affairs issues for question time and that sort of thing. But that was just a normal part of the day. Every minister represented another minister, so that sort of cross-fertilisation was happening a lot. And the other group that I had close relationships were other senior private secretaries. We used to meet regularly around, I suppose to some extent, political issues, but also government issues.
So you had like a regular weekly and daily meeting?
Well, we had, in the Hawke years, it was a fortnight thing often, but in the three Keating years, it was every week.
And that would be all the private
secretaries? All the senior private secretaries, yes.
Right. And so that, what sort of issues were on the agenda for those meetings?
Oh, look, there's a whole range of issues. One of them, one of the requirements in both chambers is the government has to have a minister or somebody in the chamber at all times. And this is a jumping a fair way ahead here, but there was a lovely incident I remember when Keating was the Prime Minister, and I think the Senate ended up with only one minister who wasn't in cabinet, and only one parliamentary secretary. And so somebody, the Bob Collins was the one minister, and raised at this meeting with Don Russell, who was Keating's senior chief of staff, I think we were called in those days. He used to chair these meetings. And I'm trying to think, I can't think of Bob Collins as senior private secretary, but anyway, he raised this issue. He said, look, we're having great problems. He said, there's only Bob and whoever the parliamentary secretary was. And when cabinet sits, and this sometimes sits all day, we have two people who have to keep the chamber running, because if there's no minister, the chamber closes. And he said, and all we've got is one minister and one parliamentary secretary. And Don Russell said, oh, look, we've got a number of parliamentary secretaries in the House. Why don't we send one of them across? Truly, that's an absolutely true story. I couldn't believe it. We all sort of, and one of his colleagues from the Prime Minister's office whispered in Don's ear, and he realised that it was a bit of a faux pas. You can't send a member of the House to the Senate or vice versa. Anyway, so that was jumping forward. But certainly, I think one of the great things about this place was relationships were as close as running into somebody in the corridor from the opposition or just a backbench senator or whatever. And of course the parliamentary press gallery was as near as going up a flight of stairs. And I used to say that you couldn't open a can of beer but everybody knew you were having a party. You could have been having a major party in your suite up the hill and nobody would have known. Mm. So it was a change in sort of those sort of dynamics about interplay with lots of other people did change in going up the hill.
Was that part of the influence why you had these meetings of all principal private secretaries or senior private secretaries meeting? Didn't meet often enough?
No, I don't think it was. I think it was really trying to make sure that we were all singing from the same hymn sheet rather than there being a... Mm. Because, you could go for weeks and not have any contact with it, another minister's office if there was no connection between you and that other minister. So it was a really an opportunity for people just to understand what was going on. So I don't think it was to do with the change of the environment, but rather just trying to be a better team. There was one other thing I wanted to talk about it that happened in the old Parliament House relating to the debate on some referendum bills. There were four referendum bills, I think, in early 88 was the time that the debate took place. And part of the constitution requires that there be an absolute majority in support of referendum bills before they could go to the people. I can't remember the precise things. I think there was freedom of religion, there was recognition of local government, and there were two others, and I can't remember
that. It was actually, according to the register I've looked at, it was one on parliamentary terms,
parliamentary
one on fair elections, one on local government, and the final one on rights and freedoms.
Rights and freedoms.
Other topics.
So we had a debate in the Senate chamber, and it was one of those debates that went forever. And because we had to have a absolute majority, we had to make sure that both the two West Australian Greens and Brian Harradine voted with the government. And they were prepared to do that. So it didn't sound like an onerous task, except for the fact the debate started early in the morning, and by 10 o'clock at night we were still going, and the opposition was being the opposition, and they were calling a division on every vote. And as the evening wore on and into the next morning, it was getting harder and harder to get all of the Labor people in particular into the chamber to vote. And we were often voting nay as well as yay. And Senator Peter Cook had the office in the absolute western corner, and they were having a party, and there was a few sherbets being shared around. And my job when the bells rang was to make sure that I went down the corridor and got them all out and pushing down the corridor. And it wasn't a long walk, certainly wasn't as long as you have to walk in this place, or in the new Parliament House, I should say. But I do remember Senator Peter Walsh had been having a few glasses of red wine, which he was wont to do. And on one occasion, I remember him walking down the corridor, bumping into each wall, singing the Internationale. Anyway, we got everything. There was then one little incident in the chamber. I used to go in with them and sat in the advisor's box while the division was counted. And this particular division, we were voting nay. So Peter Walsh went to the other side of the chamber, deliberately sat where Senator Noel Crichton Brown, another West Australian Liberal senator, sat. And he didn't have his shoes on. This is Peter Walsh. And he put his socked feet up onto the desk while the count was going on. Anyway, the division was won by the government, and everybody moves out. And I remember watching Crichton Brown walk across the chamber to his seat. He didn't sit down. He picked up papers from the desk next and went where Peter Walsh. So he brushed where Peter Walsh's socked feet had been on his desk. So that was just something that stuck in my memory. But we actually didn't finish the debate until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Parliament was due to sit again the next morning at 10 o'clock. So I remember going home, showering, shaving, getting dressed, and coming back into the office by 7:30 again. So I think, 2.5 hours. We didn't get any sleep that night. But that was, you know, an outstanding night. I don't know that we've ever sat that long before. We did sit in the Senate once, and I think it might have been up the hill. We sat on Christmas Eve one night. But
and the outcome of that, after that, all that long night, was that all the proposals were rejected.
Yeah, we got the referendum bills passed, but we lost all of the things. Yes. And that was another, I mean, that was another interesting thing, because Peter Reith ran the campaign for the opposition against Michael Tate. Michael Tate was carrying the yes votes, and we lost.
Last one. I'll find my notes here. There we go. It's possibly a bit back to a point which you have raised earlier. The travelling with a minister, or did you ever travel overseas with a minister?
Yes.
And did, when you were travelling with him, did that, how did that impact on the way you worked and the way you're fulfilling your role?
Well, I think I. Can I preface it by saying that I worked for two ministers in my time in Parliament House, both from Tasmania, but both quite different characters. I remember an incident with Senator Michael Tate where he was on a Friday afternoon to open a conference around about 1 o'clock and then go to the airport to fly back to Hobart. And he had a bad day, and he decided that he wasn't going to give the speech